Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're undertaking something that's, well, it's messy, definitely challenging, but really essential, I think. We're unpacking the life and work of Elia Kazan.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is a director the New York Times described as, what was the exact phrase? One of the most honored and influential directors in Broadway and Hollywood history.
That's the one. A man whose artistic genius, you know, it really did fundamentally reshape American performance.
But you just can't separate that legacy, can you? I mean, it's huge, monumental even, but it's tied directly to this profound political controversy.
Exactly. It defined, really, the second half of his life.
Yeah, he's such a study in contrast, this visionary director, nurturing the absolute greatest talents, you know, Hoffman, De Niro, Pacino, later influenced by his whole approach.
Right.
And then there's the other side, the political informer.
Mm-hmm.
His 1952 testimony, it left scars, real scars, on people he knew, people he worked with.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And our sources today, they really demand we look at this whole picture.
Mm-hmm.
With clear eyes, you know, acknowledge the brilliance, the miracles he created on screen,
mm-hmm.
but also the personal betrayals that kind of cast a shadow over everything.
So our mission today for you listening is to try and grasp the full sweep of the Kazan story.
Right. We'll start with his foundations, American theater, the group theater, the birth of method acting.
Mm-hmm.
That's huge in itself.
Then we'll get into his film career, which was just explosive. Defined by these really tough social issue subjects and his incredible eye for talent, discovering stars.
Unmatched, really.
Truly. But then we have to talk about the political shadow, the HUAC testimony. It's unavoidable.
Can't ignore it.
And finally, we'll look at the dynasty he left behind.
Huh.
A whole family, multi-generational of writers, actors, still working today, still shaping stories.
It's fascinating. So the big question, the one hanging over all of this.
Yeah.
It's maybe the central challenge when we look at art, isn't it?
Yeah.
How do you reconcile this transformative artistic legacy? I mean, genuinely game-changing, with an act of political compliance, of person betrayal that had such devastating consequences.
That's the tightrope. Let's try and unpack it. Okay, so to really get Kazan, to understand the intensity in his work, you have to start with his identity,
yeah.
Where he came from.
Mm-hmm.
He was born Elias Kazantzoglou in Constantinople, which is now Istanbul, of course, 1909, his parents were Cappadocian Greeks.
And this wasn't just like a biographical footnote, was it? His roots, his heritage, they were fundamental to how he saw the world, how he directed.
Absolutely fundamental. He came to the U.S. in 1913, just 4 years old, raised Greek Orthodox, pretty strict household.
And he talked a lot about feeling like an outsider, didn't he? That sense of alienation. Caught between his immigrant parents' traditions and, you know, mainstream American culture.
He really did. That tension, that feeling of being displaced, it's arguably the bedrock of his whole directorial voice. You feel it in the films.
Which leads us straight into what he considered his most personal work.
Yeah, exactly. His autobiographical novel and then the film he made from it, Americas. America, 1963.
Ah, yeah.
This film tells the story he grew up hearing about his uncle's journey. Desperate journey, really. Escaping Turkey, trying to get to America, sacrificing, well, almost everything, compromising his morals sometimes, just to get here.
And our sources, they really emphasize this Kazan called America, America, his favorite of all the films I've made.
Which is saying something, considering the classics he'd already directed by 63.
Right. Waterfront, Streetcar, East of Eden.
Yeah. He said it was the first film that was entirely mine. That tells you everything about how deeply that immigrant narrative resonated with him, capturing the desperation, the hope, the complexity of the American dream.
There's that story about the ending, too, isn't there? The character gets to New York.
Oh, yeah. Powerful stuff. Near the Statue of Liberty, he kneels down and kisses the ground passionately.
Critics apparently thought it was, what, too sentimental?
Yeah.
Naive?
Something like that. But Kazan defended it fiercely. He said, and this is a direct quote, "To oppressed people, America is still a dream." He wasn't just directing a scene. He was directing his own family history, his own emotional truth.
Wow. So before he's Kazan the director, he's Elias the student. Williams College, graduates cum laude. But he wasn't exactly privileged, right?
Not at all. Worked his way through bartender, washed dishes. That's where he got the nickname Gadge. Short for gadget.
Why gadget?
Apparently because he was seen as small, compact, and handy to have around.
Huh. Gadge. It stuck, didn't it? Really? Kind of fits that image of focused intensity. Useful.
It really does. Then came Yale School of Drama, And after that, the place that truly forged him, the group theater he joined in 1932.
And the story goes, they initially told him he wasn't cut out for acting.
Yeah, something like, he might have talent for something, but it's certainly not acting, imagine. But the group became, in his own words, his first strong sense of self in America. It was his artistic home, his family, really.
And for you listening, it's crucial to get this. The group theater wasn't just another theater company. It was, well, it was a revolution back then.
Absolutely. Founded by Lee Strasberg, Harold Clurman, Cheryl Crawford during the Depression, their whole mission was social commentary, intense psychological realism on stage.
Zan thrived there. He became known as the Proletarian Thunderbolt after his performance in Waiting for Lefty.
1935, yeah. Mm-hmm. Playing a strike-leading taxi driver, that intensity, that raw energy, it came straight from what would become the Method.
And Strasberg and Clurman were key figures for him there. Father figures, he called them.
Definitely. Especially yeah. Strasberg. Kazan describes Strasberg's influence as almost mystical. Said he had the aura of a prophet, a magician, a witch doctor, a psychoanalyst, and a feared father.
Wow, that's intense. It sounds less like an acting class and more like group therapy or something.
It kind of was, in a way, a deep psychological workshop.
So let's pause on the Method itself. We hear the term all the time. What exactly was it? And what was Kazan's role in bringing it forward? How did it break from older acting styles?
Okay, so the Method, drawing heavily from Stanislavski's system from Russia. Fundamentally, it was about stopping pretending to feel things on stage and starting to actually feel them.
Moving beyond just gestures and reciting lines beautifully.
Exactly. Moving away from that external rhetorical style towards internal psychological truth. It required actors to dig deep, use their own memories, sensory experiences, even their traumas, to connect with the character's reality.
So it's deeply personal. Which makes Kazan's later comment, every film is autobiographical, hit even harder, doesn't it?
It really does. He demanded that same vulnerability from his actors that he poured into his own most personal work, like America.
And Kazan's genius initially was taking that intensity from the sort of radical fringe of the group theater.
Which produced amazing talents like Lee J. Cobb, John Garfield.
Right, and bringing it into the mainstream American theater. His directing successes were huge. Thornton Wilder's The Skin of Our Teeth in 42.
Pulitzer winner.
And then the big ones. Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman. Tennessee Williams's A Streetcar Named Desire. These cemented him. He was the director on Broadway in the 1940s.
No question. And he made sure this approach, this school of thought, would survive. He co-founded the Actors Studio in 1947.
With Robert Lewis and Cheryl Crawford.
Right. Now, Kazan was key in starting it, but it was really Lee Strasberg who took over later and kind of codified the Method, yeah. Made it the dominant force, the sort of psychological and behavioral faith, as one source puts it, that would transform post-war Hollywood acting.
Which perfectly sets the stage for Kazan's next act.
Yeah.
Moving into cinema.
Yeah.
Taking these techniques, this intensity, onto the big screen.
So Kazan moves to film, and that philosophy, that intense personal realism, it just gets amplified. He felt the camera was actually a better tool for digging into that psychological truth he was after.
Right.
His core principle was choosing subjects rooted in personal or social issues. He said flat out, I don't move unless I have some empathy with the basic theme.
That insistence on empathy, on realism, it led him away from the typical Hollywood look, didn't it? The polished, studio-bound aesthetic.
Completely. He was actively seeking cinematic realism. So how did he achieve that, practically?
Good question.
Well, he literally took the camera out of the studio, out onto the streets. He was a real pioneer of location shooting. He wanted accuracy, grit, intensity, something that felt almost like a documentary.
Like Panic in the Streets.
Perfect example, 1950. Shot entirely on location in New Orleans. He used a style, almost cinema verite, that just wasn't common in big features then. Real people, real places, sometimes handheld cameras. It gave the drama this raw, immediate feeling, unavoidable.
It sounds like the visual equivalent of the Method acting he championed.
Yeah.
The actor digs for internal truth, the camera digs for external truth.
That's a great way to put it, precisely. And this whole quest for authenticity profoundly shaped how he cast his films.
He wasn't big on the established star system, was he?
Notoriously skeptical. He said casting was 90% of success, and he strongly preferred unknowns.
Why unknowns? What was his reasoning?
It was pretty blunt, actually. He claimed big stars are barely trained or not very well trained. They also have bad habits. They're not pliable anymore.
Pliable? That word really stands out. It suggests he needed actors who were, well, moldable, maybe without the defenses or habits of established stars.
Yeah, actors he could shape, maybe even manipulate, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
Our sources talk about his very intimate psychological approach, taking actors to dinner, meeting their families, finding the human material, as he put it, that he needed to work with or maybe exploit.
Which brings us right to the star-making legacy. It's incredible. Let's start with the obvious one, Marlon Brando.
Mm-hmm. Kazan had already directed him on stage in Streetcar, but the 1951 film version, that cemented Brando and the method on screen forever.
And Brando himself, what did he say about Kazan? He called him Gadge, right?
Yeah, he did. And he was incredibly complimentary, called Kazan the best actor's director by far, the only one who ever really stimulated me. High praise.
But there's a catch, isn't there? Brando also called him an arch manipulator of actors' feelings.
There's the dichotomy again.
What did that manipulation actually look like on set? How did Kazan operate?
It was very conscious, a psychological technique. He knew method acting often involved accessing real emotional pain, real vulnerabilities, and he wasn't afraid to find those triggers.
So for Brando, for example,
he'd identify Brando's personal tensions, maybe his issues with authority, things from his past, and then he'd subtly, or sometimes not so subtly, bring those tensions into the rehearsal room. Or even right before a take.
Wow. So he wasn't just directing the scene. He was kind of directing the actor's real life into the scene.
You could say that. He was almost psychoanalyzing them and then strategically provoking a reaction he needed for the camera.
That's ruthless.
Yeah.
That willingness to cross personal lines for the art, that's where the genius and maybe the problematic side really meet.
It certainly illuminates that central conflict we talked about. I mean, look at James Dean in East of Eden, 1955.
Kazan saw that film as deeply autobiographical, didn't he? About his own father.
Yeah, my father and me, he said. He cast Dean, this volatile unknown, precisely because he saw the alienation the character needed. He saw it in Dean.
And Kazan's description of Dean is just raw. Calling him an extreme grotesque of a boy, a twisted boy, because of a denial of love.
It sounds less like director-actor, more like therapist-patient, almost.
It really does.
And the intensity was apparently off the charts. Kazan had to practically babysit Dean. They had trailers side by side. Kazan was constantly afraid Dean would just bolt.
Really?
Yeah. He had to manage Dean's real-life feelings of being an outcast, his insecurities, to fuel that performance of Cal Trask. It was exhausting, immersive. But it resulted in an Oscar nomination for Dean's very first major film role.
Incredible. And it wasn't just the intense young man he discovered or shaped. Right. Eva Marie Saint.
Great example. Won Best Supporting Actress for On the Waterfront, her screen debut.
How did he find her?
The story is fantastic. He had her do a surprise improvisation with Brando, threw them together. And watching them, Kazan instantly saw this chemistry, this tension. He knew she had the vulnerability, but also the underlying strength. Cast her right there. Pure instinct.
Amazing. No resume needed.
Just that raw connection. Then you've got Warren Beatty and Natalie Wood in Splendor in the Grass, 1961.
He introduced Beatty to the screen in that one.
Yep. Saw this certain confidence in Beatty, the chutzpah, he called it. Beatty later said Kazan gave him his most important break. He always credited Kazan.
And Natalie Wood. She was considered kind of washed up at that point, wasn't she? Despite being so young.
Industry perception, yeah. A few bad film choices, but Kazan looked past that. He cast her and, according to critics, got the greatest emotional heights of her entire career out of her in that film.
The results just speak for themselves. His actors.
Yeah.
What was the total? 24 Oscar nominations.
24 nominations, 9 wins. That statistic alone tells you everything about his power as an actor's director. The best of his era, arguably.
And let's not forget, he was an actor's director for the writers, too. Tennessee Williams, Arthur Miller, Bud Schulberg. He was instrumental in their careers on stage and screen.
Absolutely. His relationship with Tennessee Williams was particularly deep. Williams called Kazan his most loyal and understanding friend.
There's that letter Williams wrote him.
Yeah, 1959, Williams wrote, "Someday you will know how much I value the great things you did with my work, how you lifted it above its measure by your great gift."
Wow. High praise indeed. Kazan was the bridge, wasn't he? Translating that complex literary drama into something visceral, something human, on screen and stage.
He really was. But that ability to access deep truth, it came with complications.
Which leads us to the next unavoidable part of the story.
Okay, so now we have to turn to the part of Kazan's legacy that, well, it just complicates everything, the political reality. This is where the director obsessed with truth becomes this major political lightning rod.
We're talking about the Hollywood blacklist era, the Red Scare.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically, April 1952, Kazan testifies before the House Un-American Activities Committee HUAC.
Right. And the context is key. He had been a member of the Communist Party USA, but only for a short time, about 2 years, back in the mid-1930s. Mm. Now, when he first went before HUAC, he actually refused to name names. He was under immense pressure, obviously, but he went back later that same month.
And this time he cooperated.
Fully. As a friendly witness, he named 8 people he knew from his group theater days who had also been party members, including some big names like the playwright Clifford Odets and actors Morris Karnofsky and Art Smith.
An act that was instantly divisive, and Kazan spent the rest of his life defending it, didn't he?
He did. He framed it as choosing the more tolerable of 2 alternatives, admitting both were painful and wrong. But what really set his case apart, what made it such a political flashpoint, was what he did next.
In his paper ad?
Exactly. He took out a full-page ad in the New York Times. It was defiant. He urged other people to cooperate with HUAC. He laid out his own anti-communist stance, and then came that infamous line.
I would rather hurt them a little than hurt myself a lot.
Yeah. That line, it shifted his action from just self-preservation, which many others did quietly, to this very public, almost aggressive advocacy for naming names.
And our sources trace the roots of this intense anti-communism back to his time in the group theater, right?
Yeah.
Something happened there in the 30s.
That seems to be a key part of his justification, yes. He felt betrayed by the Communist Party years earlier. Apparently, the party leadership wanted him to engineer a strike within the group theater itself.
Against the group's leadership, Strasberg and Clerman.
Seems so. And Kazan refused. He felt it would be behaving treacherously towards what he considered his artistic family.
So he felt the party itself had demanded a betrayal first.
That was his narrative. He resented the party's demands for rigid discipline, for ideological purity, for what he called confession and self-humbling.
Yeah.
He saw it as the opposite of the artistic freedom the group represented. So decades later, when HUAC came knocking, that old bitterness, that sense of having been manipulated by the party himself, seems to have fueled his decision and his defiance.
But regardless of his personal motivations, the consequences for the people he named were devastating.
Immediate and severe. Their names went on the blacklist. Their careers were, as one source puts it, damaged if not shattered. Art Smith, a really respected actor, couldn't get significant work for years.
The human cost was enormous, and it fractured relationships permanently.
Mm-hmm.
Arthur Miller, his friend, his collaborator.
Miller's reflection on it is just chilling. He said his feelings were complex, but he admitted seeing a side of Kazan that scared him. He believed Kazan would have sacrificed me as well.
Wow. That just underscores the depth of the betrayal people felt, the breakdown of trust.
It does. And you know, Orson Welles had that famous quote that sort of sums up the whole dilemma, doesn't it?
What was that?
He called Kazan a traitor, but then immediately added, he is a very good director.
Genius versus moral compromise, right there. You can't deny the talent, but the label traitor just sticks.
And that tension never went away. It exploded again almost 50 years later in 1999, when the Academy decided to give Kazan an honorary Oscar.
That was hugely controversial. I remember seeing it. Protests outside the ceremony.
Oh, yeah, about 250 demonstrators picketing. And inside, the atmosphere was electric when Kazan came on stage.
You could see it on TV. The audience was completely split. Some people sitting stone-faced, arms crossed. Ed Harris, Nick Nolte, Ian McKellen, just refusing to clap.
A silent protest against his HUAC testimony, right there in the middle of the Oscars. But then others stood up. Meryl Streep, Carl Malden, who was in Waterfront, and streetcar Warren Beatty, they gave him a standing ovation.
Why did they say they stood? What was the justification?
Well, George Stevens Jr., another director who applauded, he sort of articulated that side, saying they stood out of regard for the creativity, the stamina, and the many fierce battles and lonely nights that had gone into the man's 20 motion pictures, recognizing the work.
So it was Hollywood publicly grappling with its own history. The honor wasn't just for the films, it was for, as someone put it, the totality of what he represents, controversy included.
Exactly. The division was stark. But even that controversy, that deep split, it hasn't stopped Kazan's influence from continuing.
Like Martin Scorsese.
Perfect example. Scorsese co-directed that documentary, A Letter to Alia, in 2010. It's a really personal tribute. Scorsese credits Kazan as a massive inspiration for his own filmmaking.
The style, the realism, the psychology.
All of it. That foundation Kazan laid, particularly with the method and his approach to realism, it's still fundamental to American cinema, even if the man himself remains, you know, deeply complicated.
So Elie Kazan passes away in 2003, but that artistic force, that intense focus on the personal, the psychological truth, it didn't just disappear, did it? It seems like it flowed right into his family.
Yeah.
Creating this really fascinating multi-generational dynasty.
It really did. And you have to start with his first wife, Molly Day Thatcher Kazan. She wasn't just the wife. She was a significant figure herself.
A playwright.
Yeah. A dramatist, a playwright. Graduated Vassar, went to Yale Drama School. That's where she met Elie. She was active professionally, even headed the playwriting division at the Actors Studio for a while until 62.
So she was involved in that world, professionally influential on him even.
Seems likely, yes. Although their marriage was reportedly very difficult, strained by his constant affairs, including, famously, with Marilyn Monroe.
Right. And Molly had a role in the political side too, didn't she? According to some sources.
That's the interesting part. Sources describe her as an especially bitter anti-communist, and some even suggest she was the main author, or at least heavily involved in writing, that controversial New York Times ad where Elie defended his testimony.
Wow. So the political drama wasn't just his, it was potentially a shared stance within the immediate family.
It adds another layer, doesn't it? Now, this intensity, maybe this complexity too, seems to have passed down to their son, Nicholas Kazan.
Who became a successful screenwriter, producer, director himself.
Absolutely. Kept that family tradition going, focusing on complex characters. He got Oscar and Golden Globe nominations for Best Adapted Screenplay for Reversal of Fortune.
The Klaus von Bülow story. That was huge in 1990.
Yeah. And he wrote Francis before that, another intense biographical drama. He clearly had that knack for sharp, character-driven stories. You see the lineage from his father that focus on the interior lives.
And Nicholas married Robin Swickord, creating a real Hollywood power couple.
Definitely. Robin Swickord is a major talent, screenwriter, director, particularly known for literary adaptations. She directed the Jane Austen Book Club.
And her screenwriting credits are amazing. Little Women from 94.
Memoirs of a Geisha, Matilda. She got an Oscar nomination for the story credit on The Curious Case of Benjamin Button.
So talented. And she and Nicholas collaborated on Matilda, right? Adapting Roald Dahl.
They did. It really shows how that passion for storytelling, for screenwriting, became a family business in a way. And Robin Swickord is still very active, serves on the board of governors for the Academy.
Okay, so that brings us to the third generation, the grandchildren. And this is where it gets really interesting, with the continuation of that artistic spirit. Zoe Kazan, Nicholas and Robin's daughter.
Right, and Zoe embodies that multi-talented spirit, maybe most clearly. She's highly accomplished as both an actress and a writer, moves between stage and screen just like her grandfather did, in a way.
She made her Broadway debut back in 2008, got an Emmy nomination for Olive Kitteridge.
Fantastic miniseries.
But what's really striking is how she also takes control of the narrative, much like Elie did with America. She writes her own material.
Absolutely. She wrote and starred in Ruby Sparks. That was a big indie hit in 2012.
Love that film.
And she co-wrote Wildlife in 2018, which was critically acclaimed. Plus, she's continued acting in major stuff like The Big Sick, The Plot Against America. She clearly has that drive to write, to perform, to shape her own path.
It seems like a direct inheritance. And her sister, Maya Kazan.
Also an actress, carrying on that performance tradition. She's probably best known for TV roles like Eleanor Gallagher in The Nick.
Oh, right. And Mabel Thompson in Boardwalk Empire.
Exactly. And she's done acclaimed stage work, too. Critics praised her in The Winter's Tale for her natural radiance, unassuming intelligence, and gentleness.
It's pretty remarkable, isn't it? How that intensity, that focus needed for both writing and performing, which was so central to Elie Kazan's genius, seems to have been passed down through three generations.
It really is. The legacy isn't just about a specific style, maybe, but about that deep dedication to finding emotional truth. Whatever the medium. Hashtag, tag, tag, outro, outro.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, we're left reflecting on Elie Kazan. I mean, what a force. His relentless drive to put personal experience on screen, his own background, his conflicts, his fears. He gave us these absolute masterpieces.
Yeah.
On the waterfront, east of Eden, A Streetcar Named Desire.
Gentleman's Agreement, too.
Right. He truly defines so much of mid-20th century American culture. Artistically, just immense.
And that's why he remains so studied, so debated. I mean, think about Dustin Hoffman saying he doubted whether he, De Niro, or Pacino would have even become actors without Kazan's influence.
That's huge.
The method, that dive into psychological realism, that's his undeniable gift to acting, to filmmaking. But the political shadow, the HUAC testimony, that remains the cost, the complication.
And that cost, that whole tangled legacy of loyalty, betrayal, art, politics.
Mm.
it's actually being revisited right now in a uniquely personal way by the next generation.
Yeah, this is fascinating. Remember how Aaliyah Kazan felt East of Eden was so deeply autobiographical? That story of fathers and sons, rejection, acceptance.
Claimed it was the story of him and his own father.
Exactly. Well, guess who's writing and executive producing a brand new 7-episode TV adaptation of East of Eden right now?
My granddaughter. Zoe Kazan.
Zoe Kazan. She is actively reshaping the very narrative her grandfather called his most personal.
That connection is just incredibly powerful, isn't it? The dynasty revisiting its foundational text, in a way. A text loaded with themes of family, loyalty, betrayal, all the baggage of Aaliyah's own life.
It really is.
So it leaves us with a pretty provocative question, something for you, the listener, to think about. As this Kazan dynasty takes on this crucial story again, what new truths, what different perspectives, maybe what kind of reckoning about the American dream, about ambition, about family secrets, what will this generation choose to reveal? Especially given they've inherited both the artistic gifts and the moral complexities of that Kazan name.
What will their East of Eden tell us? That deep dive, as you say, is definitely still in progress.
Indeed it is. We'll leave you chewing on that. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.